the one high and reasonable course for the individual human being. Unless indeed he is satisfied with pursuing his personal purposes or somehow living his life until it passes out of him, is to study the laws of the becoming and take the best advantage of them to realize rationally or intuitionally, inwardly or in the dynamism of life, its potentialities in himself or for himself or in or for the race of which he is a member. His business is to make the most of such actualities as exist and to seize on or to advance towards the highest possibilities that can be developed here or are in the making. Only mankind as a whole can do this with entire effect by the mass of individual and collective action in the process of time, in the evolution of the race experience. But the individual man can help towards it in his own limits, can do all these things for himself to a certain extent in the brief space of life allotted to him. But especially his thought and action can be a contribution towards the present intellectual, moral and vital welfare and the future progress of the race. He is capable of a certain nobility of being, an acceptance of his inevitable and early individual annihilation does not preclude him from making a high use of the will and thought which have been developed in him, or from directing him to great ends which shall or may be worked out by humanity. Even the temporary character of the collective being of humanity does not so very much matter, except in the most materialistic view of existence. For so long as the universal becoming takes the form of human body and mind, the thought, the will it has developed in its human creature will work itself out, and to follow that intelligently is the natural law and best rule of human life. Humanity and its welfare and progress during its persistence on earth provide the largest field and the natural limits for the terrestrial aim of our being. The superior persistence of the race and the greatness and importance of the collective life should determine the nature and scope of our ideals. But if the progress or welfare of humanity be excluded as not our business, or as a delusion, the individual is there to achieve his greatest possible perfection or make the most of his life in whatever way his nature demands will then be life significance.
Nobody's talking.
So this kind of view of life is actually very much with us, because this is the materialistic view of life. But as Sri Aurobindo develops it, he's actually talking more about a life of a human consciousness within a material world, a material universe. A human consciousness in a material universe can also be thought of as having some persistence beyond the life of the body, that is, beyond material life. But if that is the case, then also that particular life, whatever it is completely circumscribed or contained in the material universe. So in the previous paragraph, if you remember, he pointed to this possibility, and I made mention that this possibility relates to what is known as the transmigration of the soul in Greek philosophy. Transmigration of the soul would mean that when one dies, one immediately is reborn in another material body somewhere. So there is a persistence in the in the individuality, and that persistence keeps itself in on the earth. Now, if we were to admit that, or even if we weren't to admit that, the whole thing is that a life which is completely restricted or contained within material frame is something which ultimately is without any kind of possibility of you know, sort of affecting from any other consciousness. So this soul view, or, you know, as he says, the ordinary view of the soul terrestrial life is one that, you know, is a little depressing. What happened? It's a little depressing, and it sort of can lead us towards nihilism of some sort. One idea would arise out of this, that there is no, you know, particular endurance, so to say, of anything that we can call ourselves outside of this material prison. And so we are trapped in it. So the best way is to get out of it somehow or the other by extincting ourselves. However, we can extinct ourselves through suicide of the body or of some kind of or whatever consciousness we may have. But this is not usually our, you know, life instinct. Mankind does not on earth, whether he thinks of himself at times to be constrained by the material world, mankind does not usually jump to the conclusion of suicide, of nihilism. What is more sort of possible as a kind of a nihilistic solution, which is life affirming, is the solution of what are known as the hedonists. And hedonistic solutions, hedonist is basically one who says that take no care of tomorrow, let's enjoy today, because tomorrow we have no certitude of any kind of existence remaining in us. I mean, we may disappear tomorrow. So let's make the best of today. Let's enjoy to the best of our ability. Now, some people believe that there was an ancient dispute in Greece between, just 1 second, I think it's Sita, I think my parents at using my Skype ID are trying to log in.
Okay.
Maybe they want to participate in the in this meeting. Okay, so to continue, so we have this possibility, just 1 second. Yeah, I was talking about hedonism. So we have this possibility that, you know, one enjoys for the day, as it were, because tomorrow we may not have any existence. Now, I was also saying that there was an ancient Greek dispute about this. And this is known as the dispute between the Stoics and the Epicures, the Epicurean and the Stoic dispute. The Stoics, you see, these philosophies are also all rooted in materialism, in a sense. So to the Stoic, the idea was that our existence over here is ultimately, you know, pessimistic. There is no, you know, sort of eventual sort of solution to it. We disappear. We have no persistence outside of the material universe. But we have a certain kind of nobility to us. And as a result, we have to grit our teeth and bear everything with a kind of a very, that's why that whole idea of the phrase, the Stoic attitude, that's where it has come from. That we have to endure life, endure it with a certain, you know, sort of a kind of a sternness. And the opposite standpoint to this was what is known as the Epicurean standpoint. The Epicurean standpoint was originally characterized by the Stoics as eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. This was the slogan. Okay. Now in India we had exactly the same kind of Epicurean philosophy coming from the people known as the Charvaks. Charvak philosophy was exactly the same, that borrow from others, you know, have good food, enjoy your life, because tomorrow you will die. So persistence of existence in you know, any reality outside of the material world denied, it is very easy to come to this kind of a attitude. But Sri Aurobindo is saying that sort of either the nihilistic attitude or this kind of hedonistic attitude ultimately is very depressing to the human spirit. And something in us in the long run, whether we believe in material life or not, cannot subject itself to that sort of, you know, sort of license. That's why, as you see, he says over there, even the temporary character of the collective being of humanity does not so very matter, much matter, except in the most materialist view of existence. So that those ones that I talked about are those most materialist views of existence. For so long as the universal becoming takes the form of human body and mind, the thought, the will it has developed in its human creature will work itself out. And to follow that intelligently is the natural law and the best rule of human life. In other words, we are, you know, we don't need to go against the grain of whatever cosmic forces are working in us, even temporarily. Why not sort of, you know, do the best that we can within those limits? That is more properly the human attitude. So, you know, I mean, though there is a pessimistic side to it, and Greek philosophy has developed that to a very, very great extent, you have the notion, for example, of the myth of Sisyphus, who pushes a rock up a hill till it gets to the top, and then it drops back down to the bottom of the hill, and he goes back and pushes it up again. Day after day, this is what he does. See, there is a kind of eternal recurrence there, but it is an entrapment. There is no escape from it. So that kind of a imprisonment is the notion of life here, or of an escape, which is really a disappearance, an extinction, complete extinction. So what can we do about it? What is the good that can come out of it? Well, there are two possible solutions. One is self-culture, and the other is to work for the good of that which will remain. So the Greeks actually moved more in the direction of self-culture. That's why the whole ethic of the Greek life was a sound life and a sound body, a sound mind and a sound body. And that kind of an ethic prioritized living one's own brief existence or not so brief existence on earth, cultivating one's faculties, cultivating one's sort of abilities. That's the origin of the word culture, actually, when applied to the human individual. You know, culture also has to do with tilling the soil, you know, culturing the environment. But culture applied as to self-culture in the Greek sense, is related to this notion. Now, in modern times, we still have this kind of a view, a materialist view, a view of human existence, particularly arising from the Renaissance through the Enlightenment, through the Age of Science, which prioritizes matter as the primary reality, the only exclusive reality, consciousness as an accident in matter. The view over here has tended to be that individuals may get snuffed out in one existence, but what has persistence is the collective life of humanity. That is, mankind lives on. So we would be justified not so much in self-culture, but in leaving our contribution for the future of the human race. Now, this in a sense is one of the kind of justifications for science. You know, we work in our lifetime and leave a certain kind of understanding, and that understanding is utilized by those who come after us. And the same kind of attitude can be applied to society and the amelioration of collective human life. Socialism, for example, is a kind of a philosophy based rooted in materialism, which moves in that direction. We also have philosophers, more modern philosophers, existentialist philosophers, for example, like Sartre or Camus, particularly Jean-Paul Sartre, who take this similar kind of stance. His major work is called Being and Nothingness. And basically what he's pointing to is that there is a nothingness within which being is, you know, our, you know, the essence of our life is disappearance in death. So we are being upheld by the nothingness of death. We are like a ghost walking on this material world, even while we live. So how can we find any kind of justification for our life here? What is going to give us any, you know, sort of, you know, idealism in this life? And for people like Sartre and Camus, it became socialism, because we are going to, we don't have any sort of sense of enduring happiness except in being able to adopt an ideal. We adopt an ideal for the betterment of the human race in future. And we can do that by trying to eradicate whatever kinds of inequalities there may be to society. So these kinds of philosophies arise as nobility, as noble philosophy. Sri Aurobindo is saying over there. Where is he saying? He is capable of a certain nobility of being, an acceptance of his inevitable and early individual annihilation does not preclude him from making a high use of the will and thought which have been developed in him, or from directing them to great ends which shall or may be worked out by humanity. Now he is ending it by basically pointing out that even if we don't give much value to society at large, still the use of our faculties, some contemporary philosophies have gone in that direction. They are reviving the old Greek sort of idea of self-culture, that life is here for us to apply our will, not so much to the betterment of others, but really to the betterment of ourselves. That does not necessarily have any outcome in the long run, because you know, it is the brief span of one material life, or even of lives separated but ultimately without any kind of you know, continuity in any sort of progression. But we can within that particular lifetime put our will towards you know, creating a good house, as it were. Creating a beautiful sort of, you know, I mean, psychological I mean, constitution of ourselves. So this is the you know, cosmic terrestrial view and the kind of ideals it leads to.
So, Debashis, can I ask a question?
Yes.
So, in these views, How do they account for things like emotions and the source of
Exactly.
your mental ideas or
Exactly.
these viewpoints themselves?
Yes, they account for them as sort of the conditions of consciousness that has appeared as an accident within material. It's like a mushroom, which has some properties. So, though it's a very temporary existence rooted in matter, it has certain attributes called consciousness that are recognizable by others who have consciousness. And those attributes are things such as emotions, thoughts, ideas, etc. They mean something in the sphere of those other beings who have those particular kinds of properties, but to existence or reality itself, they have no meaning.
Devashishta, this is Sita here.
Yes, yeah.
Emotion, as a form of self-excellence, it will become a form of rasa, which will be left behind as a concrete contribution, right?
Explain again. Explain it.
Okay,
how would it be left behind?
because let us say an emotion and become in its purest sense can become a rasa of some kind, be it an artist, be anybody who excels in expressing that emotion.
Expressing of emotion, yes.
It will be left as a concrete thing for the welfare of the collective, right?
Yes, if you're talking about expression of emotion, undoubtedly. Now, experience of emotion in and by itself can also be experienced as rasa, as you're saying. Now, the whole idea of rasa. Rasa or a certain kind of a heightened or sublimation of experience. Experience or emotion as leading to a certain state of impersonal delight. That is rasa. So we may have experiences of that kind spontaneously or naturally out of our experiences in the world. But we may also express these in some enduring form, in art forms, for example. Now, if we express these in art forms, then they have a certain endurance outside the individual life. And sure, they become forms of culture in that sense, forms of universal culture, and others at other times can also experience them. We have managed to give them a certain body in matter.
Thank you.
But that body in matter would only, according to this viewpoint, that persistence in matter of states of emotion as rasa or as sublimated, delight, would be only certain kind of internal contributions to the race, to the collective that can experience these things. But has no reality outside that. In other words, even if we say that rasa has a certain universality to it, we can experience that universality. This is what allows us to classify the arts and kind of criticize works of art and think of things as having a certain kind of universal appeal. Even though Shakespeare comes to us, from 600 years back and Kalidas comes to us from 1,400 or 500 to 600 years back. But the thing is that from this point of view, that would still be only a specialized enjoyment of the human species and has no kind of universality in reality.
So I didn't quite understand the last portion of that comment. Self-excellence is no difference from good how is these two philosophies different? Because self is part of the collective, right?
Yeah, but you see, if let's say you spend your whole life actually doing physical exercises to develop good muscles and kind of, you know, use your mind to do logical exercises so that your mind becomes very perfect in its logic and all that, and even if you express it in the world around you, it is not your interest to give it any endurance for others. You're doing it for yourself. Then there is no necessity that it will have any kind of effect on the collective life of mankind after you die. But if you do it with that conscious aim, even if you're doing certain, you know, physical exercises or whatever, you do it with a conscious aim that, you know, you leave a teaching behind out of the, you know, experience and experiments of self-culture, something will endure for others to use, then you're doing it for the collective good of mankind. That's the difference. It's only a difference of internal attitude, of philosophy.
Debashish Da, this is Lopa. I have a question. So for people who believe in this line of thought of living one life fully and trying to develop the material aspect of life, do they need the concept of reincarnation?
No. You see, the Greeks developed the concept of transmigration of soul because they have a notion of the becoming as eternal. Now, as he pointed out over there, that our terrestrial sort of existence that actually, you know, has a certain persistence would also imply that the human consciousness has a certain persistence in it. So, though that human consciousness is not given any kind of, you know, reality in the sense of a continuity of development, why we persist on this planet is not given any kind of concrete answer, because there is a sort of continuity to the material world, and there is the sense of the continuity of consciousness as well. So for them, it is enough to say that when person dies, the consciousness moves into another body. That there is any kind of relationship with karma, for example, or that there is any growth of the consciousness from life to life, or that there is any eventual end to this kind of, you know, reincarnation, those questions have no meaning.
Okay, and since they don't believe in some other plane, so the soul,
yes,
or the entity within has to get into another body.
It was echoing too much. Can you repeat that?
Yeah, I was saying that this transmigration of souls, they have to come with the theory of the soul moving from one terrestrial body to another terrestrial body because they don't believe in supra-terrestrial planes. Is that right?
They do have the notion of domains in which the gods and the you know, beings, the titans, etc., exist. But these worlds are also here. You know, for example, the Greek gods live in Mount Olympus. Now, interestingly, for us also, the Hindu gods live in the Himalaya. Shiva lives in Mount Kailash. But at the same time, our notion is that Mount Kailash or the Himalayas are a physical touchstone or touching point for supraphysical worlds, for worlds, heaven worlds that are non-material.
So did the Charvakas also have the concept of reincarnation?
No, the Charvaka philosophy is a materialist philosophy. So because they were saying, we have no need to believe in reincarnation. You see, and because in Indian philosophy you have the whole gamut of positions. What from one, that is the only and probably the most rare example, but it's almost like the exception proves the point. So it has been given a place in our darshanas that this is also a possibility, that we don't have any persistence, that we end with the end of the body. So let's make the best of, you know, enjoyment of all the brief day that we live here. The other one, of course, in Buddhism, we have a persistence, but that persistence has no substantial reality. In other words, that persistence is also a kind of nihilism. As if we can break the sort of illusion of consciousness, then what remains is only nothingness. So Buddhism is also a materialism from that point of view. Buddhism is another kind of, you know, transmigration of the soul type of philosophy, except that it allows for karma and as determining the kinds of experience we have on earth. But its basis is material, and it gives no reality to consciousness except as a enduring form of certain subjective impressions held together by desire, the momentum of desire.
Okay, thank you.
Devashish, I have
yes.
a question, probably slightly unrelated. Could you take a step back and talk about how and why some of us are attracted to certain ideals or certain darshanas, and some others are attracted to some to certain other darshanas? Is it because of just the circumstances of life experiences, or is it some kind of connection that we may have with some other intuition, or I mean anything else?
Yes, I think you know, we touched upon this a little bit earlier. In Indian sort of thinking, there is the notion of adhikarvad. Adhikarvad means that, you know, you can, I mean, it has many implications, but you can sort of roughly translate it as the capacity of the soul, the ripeness of the soul. What is the level at which the soul is at any particular time? So, Adhikarvad also has got two components to it. One is Swabhava. Swabhava and Swadharma. Swabhava and Swadharma are its enduring component. In other words, each of us already comes with a sort of preordained predisposition, an orientation. Again, we can go further behind into talking about gods and goddesses, Ishta Devata, and you know, aspects of personalities of the divine that we are born out of, spiritually speaking, that relate to Swabhava and Swadharma. But the other aspect to Adhikarvad is evolutionary. In other words, whatever be your Swabhava and Swadharma, at any particular life, in any particular life, you have a certain you know, kind of partial possession of your own capacities as a soul. Now, this partial possession is also related to nature, prakriti, because we take a body, you know, the soul is related to nature. Nature as a combination of, you know, sort of mentality, will, emotion, subtle physical components, all these and impressions, you know, the samskaras. All these kinds of natural components of our existence are actually chosen by the soul in its evolution. So our prakritic body is actually related to you know, kind of the ultimately antaratma's choice. So this kind of a setup, a composition, predisposes us to certain philosophies, you may say. So at any time, we may actually be, you know, sort of oriented towards affirming a certain kind of reality. And out of that, the mind builds a philosophy.
I'm understanding you as saying that all these swabhavas and swadharmas, they are all completely in the field of prakriti.
No, I didn't say that. I'm saying that swabhava, swadharma are one aspect of the adhikarvad of the soul. So adhikarvad really relates to the development of the soul. So, swabhava and swadharma are actually the intrinsic, swabhava means the kind of, self-being of the psychic being, you may say. And swadharma is the law of its manifestation. So, at any time, at any point, even these things have certain predispositions. They have certain partialities also. Like, swabhava and swadharma ultimately predispose us towards, internally, towards the chaturvarna. You know that Brahmin, Kshatriyas, Vaishya, Sudra. Now, these internal realities are not realities of the Prakriti, they are realities of the Purusha. And they express through the Prakriti. Now, even in each of these, there is a progression. So, there will be a predisposition towards knowledge. For example, in that person whose swabhava is that of the Brahman, or swadharma is that of the Brahman. So, that predisposition towards knowledge will also have its stages of growth, depending on the evolution of the soul in any one particular lifetime. So, it will be a philosopher of a certain kind, you see. So, that's how nature, the field of nature gives a certain kind of a constraining, stamp to the growth of the psychic being.
Okay. Thank you, Debashish. Sorry for diverting this.
That will also lead to certain kinds of experiences, because if, depending on your orientation predisposition, you will, it's ultimately everything is orientation. We are not static beings. The whole creation is a revolutionary creation, and human beings particularly, we are as beings. We are, that's why Krishna is saying, "You are what your faith is." Jo yachshraddha sa eva sa. Now, that faith that each of us is our orientation or predisposition towards experience, and ultimately the experiences that we'll have, the realizations that we'll have, are also dependent upon this particular aspect of the adhikar. If there's at a certain time a certain predisposition towards, say the nirvana, that is what we will realize. Our faith will be in nirvana, and our realization will be of nirvana. But at the same time, we may not. At the borders of the nirvana, we may still have some sort of reservation. And that's why, for example, what happens in Savitri, when Ashwapati reaches the borders of the unknown, and even when he gets dissolved, so to say, in the unknowable, still there is a certain persistence of aspiration. He does not cede his aspiration to that realization. And that is what allows it to continue bringing new experiences into him.
Beautiful. Thank you very much, Debashishta.
Okay, so we are 10 in the conference call. Somebody has the microphone not muted. Debashita, do your parents know about this microphone muting?
I'm not sure, Lupa. Maybe, I don't know if they can be, my father can be asked if he has muted the microphone.
He can go to the call. Yeah, the call menu, and there'll be a mute microphone in the call menu. And does Jyoti want to join? I can see her online. And does Srila Krishnan want to join? Because in that case, what we can do... Okay, so if Jyoti doesn't want to join, we are fine. But if next time something like that happens and we are already 10, I have Meera and LK's contact in my YM. So we can drop LK and Meera and I can call them through my YM. But today I think we are fine. Shall we read the next paragraph?
Meera, can you read?
Yeah, I'll read it. The supraterrestrial view admits the reality of the material cosmos, and it accepts the temporary duration of Earth and human life as the first fact we have to start from. But it adds to it a perception of other worlds or planes of existence which have an eternal or at least a more permanent duration. It perceives behind the mortality of the bodily life of man the immortality of the soul within him. A belief in the immortality, the eternal persistence of the individual human spirit apart from the body, is the keyword of this conception of life. That of itself necessitates its other belief in higher planes of existence than the material or terrestrial. Since for a disembodied spirit there can be no abiding place in a world whose every operation depends upon some plane of force, whether spiritual, mental, vital or material, in and with the forms of matter. There arises from this view of things the idea that the true home of man is beyond, and that the earth life is in some way or other only an episode of his immortality, or a deviation from a celestial and spiritual into a material existence.
I'm wondering, maybe you can read the next one also, because this was a short one. We can take the two paragraphs together.
Yeah, I'll do that. But what then is the character, the origin, and the end of this deviation? There is first the idea of certain religions, long persistent but now greatly shaken or discredited, that man is a being primarily created as a material living body upon earth, into which a newly born divine soul is breathed, or else with which it is associated by the fiat of an almighty creator. A solitary episode, this life is his one opportunity from which he departs to a world of eternal bliss or to a world of eternal misery, either according as the general or preponderant balance of his acts is good or evil, or according as he accepts or rejects, knows or ignores a particular creed, mode of worship, divine mediator, or else according to the arbitrary predestining caprice of his creator. But that is the supraterrestrial theory of life in its least rational form of questionable creed or dogma. Taking the idea of the creation of a soul by the physical birth as our starting point, we may still suppose that by a natural law common to all, the rest of its existence has to be pursued beyond in a supraterrestrial plane, when the soul has shaken off from it its original matrix of matter, like a butterfly escaped from the chrysalis and disporting itself in the air on its light and colored wings. or we may suppose preferably a pre-terrestrial existence of the soul, a fall or descent into matter, and a re-ascension into celestial being. If we admit the soul's pre-existence, there is no reason. Conceivably, assume for some purpose the human body and nature. But this is not likely to be the universal principle of earth existence or a sufficient rationale for the creation of the material universe.
So here he is taking this standpoint of the supraterrestrial reality of existence. And by supraterrestrial he means that there are other worlds than this material universe, other universe, non-material, you may say, worlds. The reality to non-material worlds. You know, when we were talking, for example, of, you know, sort of the persistence of the human consciousness beyond the body, but trapped in the material world, on the material or in the material world, there are other kinds of views of life related to that, or at least practical kinds of understandings of the material world related to that. These are the early kind of religions, what are mostly in almost all cultures, there are these propitiatory animistic religions, what are called animistic religions. Animistic religions implies that in our perception of the world, we see that there is a world of matter, but that there are spirits which, you know, sort of control every material manifestation or phenomenon that we see. Every object has behind it a certain another substratum of spirits. Now, if you were to consider that these spirits are also in some way sort of, you know, kind of rooted in the material world, then it would have been a terrestrial existence. But if we are to assume that all things have some kind of spirits connected with them, we are already affirming that they must have their own firmament. In other words, a subtle world. And this is what ultimately leads in its own development to the Platonic notion of idea worlds, that there is a whole hierarchy of these kinds of subtle worlds, worlds of spirit, worlds of will, worlds of contesting kind of, you know, intention, worlds of rationality, and ultimately great ideas. Everything comes out of an idea. And you know, the whole thing, you know, Neoplatonism takes it further up to the logos, the original idea out of which everything has taken shape or materialized. Now, in the Indian conception, we have also this notion of what one might call pantheism. You know, in the Greek conception also, we have the notion of pantheism, that is, there are many, many gods or spirits controlling the variety of phenomena and realities in nature and in human existence. So where do they have their origin? You know, so naturally they also have their origin in the Indian sense also they have their origin in a whole series of invisible worlds, of subtler worlds. Now connected with that is the idea of the consciousness, and in fact this itself, even to I mean, as an intuition, you may say, the intuition of spirits behind the material world comes to us even in its most primitive form due to the fact that we have in us, we intuit in ourselves something which is spirit-like, non-material, our consciousness. So, to give some kind of explanation for that consciousness, we can either say that the most basic explanation is that it is just an accident of properties generated in matter, or we can say no, it has some independence. It is an independent spiritual entity within the material world. Now, in the previous paragraphs, we considered the fact that if that is so, even then it might be completely constrained by material form, from one material form to another. But the point he's making over here is that there is something unsatisfactory about this. And, you know, to take a little further the question asked by Shyam last time about where do all these philosophies come from and why is Sri Aurobindo considering so many philosophies, it is because to some extent Sri Aurobindo believes, you know, it's very, very interesting because this is, we are in the age of, you know, comparative studies. We are at a time when we are actually being able to review all the various philosophies, thoughts, ideas.
Everybody went.
Chitan unlocked it.
Chitan, huh?
Think that will ultimately lead to integrality. So, if we are to think of ourselves as belonging to a point of time where we can review, in a sense, all these various ways in which we have approached reality, we may also probe these various approaches to reality in our intuitive sense. So these are all arising out of intuitions of reality, intuitions of experience, and ultimately these intuitions also have a certain kind of weight. When we put them side by side and we probe them, there is a certain weight and we feel that, okay, yes, this is in some sense more satisfactory. This in some sense is answering various of the questions that we have put. Not just in a mental way, but in a internal way, in a sort of intuitive psychic way. So this whole idea about the persistence of consciousness, he is approaching it in a mental way, almost through logic. But behind that logic is a probing of our intuition. And the point that he makes over there is that if indeed we had something independent called consciousness, not just an epiphenomenon of matter, and that consciousness was constrained to move from one physical existence to another, transmigrate from one physical or material existence to another, then there is a certain something unsatisfactory over there with that, you know, notion. I'm trying to sort of get to the quotation over here. Let's see. Yeah. A belief in the immortality, the eternal persistence of the individual human spirit, apart from the body, is the keyword of this conception of life. Okay, so that this consciousness has a independence from the life of the body. That of itself necessitates its other belief in higher planes of existence than the material or terrestrial, since for a disembodied spirit there can be no abiding place in a world whose every operation depends upon some play of force, whether spiritual, mental, vital, or material. in and with the forms of matter. So here that, you know, if matter is tying, if all our existence is tied to matter, if matter is the determining regime of all our experiences, then there is no real need for the persistence of consciousness, see, and the independence of consciousness from matter. If there is the independence of consciousness from matter, then we must assume a more proper home for that consciousness, a spiritual home for that consciousness, a consciousness home for it. So that is the master intuition behind this supra-terrestrial idea. Where is the true home of that in us which is not material? It cannot be matter, because it is not comfortable, alien to this realm of matter. So that alienation is addressed. That intuition of the alienation of spirit in matter is addressed by this idea of the supra-terrestrial existence. So then he goes on to talk about what would be the possibilities then. Okay, that just if we assume that there is a certain independence to spiritual life or to the spirit in man and to the worlds that are behind this material world, some kind of spirit worlds, then what kind of experience or existence does the human being have? One, we may say that this human consciousness ultimately is not of any other world, but born out of this world. It's like it takes its birth on material soil. It is breathed into matter by some creator, as he's pointing out over here. This is the whole notion of creationism. Creationism is a Judeo-Christian concept, and Judeo-Christian sort of philosophies believe that there is a creator and the world of creation, and the creator has breathed life into material molds, and these are the different creatures. Now, this creature, however, whatever has been breathed into it is of spirit form, and therefore this spiritual form can persist beyond the material mold into which it has been breathed. And so, though its origin is in matter, its persistence is in eternal lives outside of this material world. A material life becomes a solitary episode, as he says. A solitary episode, this life is his one opportunity from which he departs to a world of eternal bliss or to a world of eternal misery. So here also, what kind of other worlds can we have? We can have other worlds which are actually divided in a dualistic sense of ethical values. That they are good worlds and bad worlds. Worlds of happiness and worlds of sorrow. Worlds of misery. And that would give some kind of rationale to a certain ethical orientation in the material world as we live here. If we live a good life over here, a sort of a virtuous life, then when we die, we move into a spirit world which is happy, that of eternal bliss. And if we lead a kind of a sort of evil life here, then we move into another world, which is the world of eternal misery. And what actually determines or decides that is some kind of cosmic mechanism, either the fiat of God himself, or his agents, or his law courts. So these are the sort of views which relate to a certain sort of set of philosophies. But as he says, this is a kind of a little bit of a primitive view within the supra-terrestrial form, supra-terrestrial theory. So instead, he says that even if the soul is being born in the material or physical body for the first time, I mean, it's appearing through the creator's, sort of act in the physical body, still it may be that the rest of his existence is to be pursued in a supra-terrestrial plane. So in other words, we may actually tie this you know, soul existence to the earth only in the sense of its origin, but as having nothing really or substantially to do with where it will take him outside of the material world. In other words, after death, the spirit will move or range in many kinds of worlds, and each of these worlds will give it some sort of experiences. It will never come back to a material world, and it will basically sort of range about in spiritual worlds. As he says, when the shown is shaken off, so it's basically this material sort of body is a certain kind of encasing for that soul, and just like the sort of chrysalis, you know, the sort of caterpillar metamorphoses into the butterfly or moth, never comes back to an existence as a caterpillar. So to this particular existence gives us a certain type of experience, and then we metamorphose and move into subtle worlds where we range in other kinds of bodies. And then he takes up another sort of thing that, okay, this why at all a beginning in a material world? If the primary reality is that of supraterrestrial worlds, then this material existence may be just a certain plane into which we drop by accident and out of which we come out and never return to it again. Now, this, why do we drop here then? And that would have to do with some kind of mechanism. Either it would be a random thing, or it would be some kind of mechanism, as, for example, the notion of Gandharvas, like in Kalidasa, you know, the sort of Yaksha drops to the earth because of some sort of sin committed in the other worlds. So you may have, you know, that kind of a temporary sort of, I mean, existence on this planet, on this material universe. But then there is another one that he brings up, which is that this is a temporary. If we admit the soul's pre-existence, there is no reason to exclude this last possibility as an occasional spiritual occurrence. A being of another plane of existence may conceivably assume, for some purpose, the human body and nature. Now, even apart from that example I gave, it may be, as in the Greek sense, the entry of the gods, or even in the Indian sense, gods may come to just taste. It's a certain kind of taste. It's a flavor that they want to experience, and so they take a human life for a little bit, have that experience, and get out of it. But that kind of an explanation would not give any universal justification to the material universe or to the principle of earth existence. So that's how he kind of rounds it up, you know, that this kind of primacy given to the existence of spirit worlds, because there is an independence of the consciousness, that the material world has only a kind of a subsidiary or a secondary or a very temporary utility, or, you know, just a kind of a location for consciousness, is somehow unsatisfying to our sense of the meaning of material existence.
So, Devashishta, in the previous two theories, he didn't seem to speak of any creator. Was that because those two theories never really even needed a creator to explain the existence, or is there any other reason that I'm missing?
No, he did not talk about a creator. Yes, you're right, because firstly, in the absolute or what did he call it?
Supracosmic.
The supracosmic theory of existence, there is ultimately no real creation. So the creation is a kind of an illusion. So, and we are trapped in that illusion. So creator idea is not so important there. Creator is somebody who has by will deliberately created a world, a universe. In the second one, again, creator idea is not necessary there, because we may assume that material universe is fundamental and is eternal. It has always existed. Nobody has created it. Or if there is consciousness in it, either the consciousness is just born out of it by without any kind of origin. Or if there is any other origin, then that other origin cannot be outside of the material universe. So material universe itself can be thought of as a creator. See. But he does not really give it that kind of, orientation either.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Devashish, a more general question. So, when you are doing this kind of comparative study or looking at different theories side by side, how do you empty your predispositions which come from knowing other theories from knowing other theories? So when you want to study or analyze a particular theory, you really have to empty yourself of ideas that have come in from other theories that you may know. So is that only a question of training the mind to just empty itself, or how do you do that?
Yeah, this is a very good question. It has to do with methodology of comparative understanding. And there is a sort of many philosophers in modern times have actually tried to address just this issue. Most important of them perhaps is somebody called Gadamer, and his major book is called Truth and Method. And it's the general field in philosophy is called hermeneutics, or how to interpret things, how to interpret, a variety of different or comparative approaches. There's two approaches to this. One is exactly what you said, that is, empty ourselves of all our predispositions, and then we try to rethink anew all these various things as if they are absolutely brand new and equally important conceptions. But that is not easy, and not only I don't even know if it is possible to humanity as he is right now. If we reach a certain level of impersonality of the mind bordering on the cosmic or universal mind, if we actually sort of open our minds to what Sri Aurobindo calls the higher mind, which is just above or beyond the human mind plane, then it is possible. And maybe we are, as a human race, at that border. We are actually quite close to affirming the higher mind in our philosophical existence. That's why this study. But at the same time, there is another way in which we can proceed, and that is by bringing our predispositions with ourselves, but by being very, very conscious of what it is that we are studying, which is also in a sense what we are doing over here. That is, when we study other kinds of philosophies or other kinds of approaches to test every inch of ground on the basis of our own predispositions, but as soon as we find something which does not tally, we turn the light of that particular understanding upon our predispositions as well and relativize it. It is through a constant attempt to relativize what we take for granted that we arrive gradually at a more comprehensive knowledge.
Beautiful. Obviously it's not an easy task, because these things just keep coming in the way all the time.
Yes, and we take so much for granted. This whole field is actually very, very important aspect of what in academics today is called culture studies. Because we all come from traditions. From childhood, we are brought up in certain kinds of beliefs, and those beliefs become ingrained in us, and those beliefs themselves ultimately go back to fundamental worldviews like the ones we are discussing. right now, combinations of these things. And so in an unconscious way, we are actually affirming a variety of these things. No human being is without predispositions. And so the whole thing becomes, when we come face to face with the other, in whatever way, how are we to take it? Are we to dismiss it? Are we to cloister ourselves from it? Are we to refuse? Are we to create a world of us and them and refuse a reality to the them? Are we to attempt to enter into dialogue and create a synthetic reality? Or are we to rise above these things to a new station in which things are all put in place? Everything is seen for what it is. If we believe in that last option, that is the integral option. That is the option that Sri Aurobindo is presenting to us. He is saying, yes, it is possible. But to get to there, we have to actually take the light of our deepest intuitions along with us and test each of these things in that light fearlessly in a kind of a bid to dissolve all our preconditions as well as the preconditions of others.
So once you start trying to remove these preconditions or these prejudices, then you frequently come to the point that, I mean, so what do you really know?
Yeah, ultimately, you see, it's what Krishna says, drop all the dharmas and come to me alone. We ultimately, all these dharmas are our conventions. Mm-hmm. All the dharmas that Arjuna has brought with him to the battlefield are put into question in that battlefield. And at that moment, Sri Krishna is showing him all those dharmas side by side. He brings all of them together. And then he says, drop them and come to me. Because I am your own highest reality. And in that highest reality, you will find the meaning of all these dharmas. So that is the yoga. In a sense, we are being told that there is a root. There is a knowledge with a capital K, a vidya. And that vidya is what we see. That vidya is not the vidya that comes from a study of evidence and a kind of a plastering together of various sorts of ideas and opinions. But the light of that vidya comes to us with our intuition and our orientation towards it. And gradually it increases in us as we open ourselves to it in the, sort of largeness of this philosophical inquiry.
Beautiful. Thank you, Debashista. Very nice.
Debashista, to get back to the creation theory, or more close to the text. This is what my thinking is, and I want you to say if it is correct. It is that finally when we came to the Puranic age, the need to explain this creation became more urgent than what it was before. So in that point, the stories of creation came about in the Hindu religion or Sanatana Dharma, about the fact that we have this Hiranyagarbha who creates, or Brahma who creates the first Manu, and that Manu creates the Prajapatis, and Prajapatis create humans.
That's interesting. Yes, possibly that is the case, because you see what happens is that the pre-Puranic period, the Upanishadic period, leading in its sort of cycle through the Buddhist period and the early Buddhist period, Buddha himself, is a very wide-ranging period of philosophies which don't necessarily give that importance to creator. It's more interested in primary principles of being and becoming and the individual existence, but not so much of the what is to be done here, what kind of life are we to lead, what is our relationship with the cosmos in ethical terms, for example. You know, that whole, the ethical cycle, you may say, that we enter into, you know, after the Upanishadic period. I mean, the ethical cycle is also present there in its beginnings in the Upanishads, but, you know, Shreyas and Priyas, making a distinction between that, is the essence of ethics. But what starts happening is much more the, you know, understanding of the relationship of the individual to the cosmic in terms of duties, in terms of good and evil, in terms of karma, those kind of ideas. And also a theistic element comes in. A theistic element is very important. I think it's an advance, actually, in spiritual thinking, because it is the affirmation of the fact that being is also personal, that ultimate being is not merely a abstract principle, but an impersonal mm-hmm. principle, but is a person. And when, as soon as we admit that, we start relating to being as a person, and that it then becomes the relationship of the creator and the created, various ways or hierarchies of that relationship are then developed.
Yeah, already in the Gita we hear about the Purushottama, right? The personal divine.
Yeah, Gita is a very, very powerful theistic text, actually. I mean, Gita is actually, I think I would say the Gita is kind of, I mean the whole subtext and the message of the Gita is really an affirmation of God as person.
But in terms of when it came, it was just after the Upanishads and much before the Puranas. Right?
Yes, no doubt. Gita is, you may say, one of the earliest theistic texts. It predates Buddhism. It predates the Buddha, for sure.
Is Buddhism theistic?
No, Buddhism is atheistic. It does not believe in the personal aspect of God, and it does not believe in God either.
But subsequently, Mahayana Buddhism introduced these beings like the gods. May not be the Purushottama
Mahayana
God.
Right, those are the Bodhisattvas. Buddhism in later periods incorporates theistic ideas into it. Still, I don't know whether you can call it theistic, but it incorporates theistic ideas.
Though the Sanskrit word nastic and atheistic, they are not the same. Is that not right?
No.
Yeah.
Astika and Nastika have to do with philosophies of being and non-being as the primary realities.
Oh, very simplistically, it was like philosophies that follow the Vedas and philosophies that do not base on the Vedas.
Yes, that mm-hmm. is the more sort of simplistic, division or understanding. Shall we read one more, or are we at the edge of our time?
No, there is time. It's 9:05. We have till 9:30, like usually we do till 9:30.
Yeah.
So if you have time, okay. We can certainly do. Angelo has not read. Angelo, do you want to read?
I can read.
Perhaps Angelo has his microphone muted.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Perhaps I didn't. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, Angelo, we can hear you.
Oh, thank you. I was reading away.
Oh, okay.
Let me begin again. It is also sometimes supposed that the solitary life on Earth is a stage only, and the development of the being nearer to its original glory occurs in a succession of worlds, which are so many other stages of its growth, stadia of its journey. The material universe, or Earth especially, will then be a sumptuously appointed field created by divine power, wisdom, or caprice for the enacting of this interlude. According to the view we choose to take of the matter, we shall see in it a place of ordeal, a field of development, or a scene of spiritual fall and exile. There is, too, an Indian view which regards the world as a garden of the divine lila, a play of the divine being, with the conditions of cosmic existence in this world of an inferior nature. The soul of man takes part in the lila through a protracted series of births, but it is destined to reascend at last into the proper plane of the divine being, and there enjoy an eternal proximity and communion. This gives a certain rationale to the creative process and the spiritual adventure, which is either absent or not clearly indicated in the other accounts of this kind of soul movement or soul cycle. Always, there are three essential characteristics in all these varying statements of the common principle. First, the belief in the individual immortality of the human spirit. Secondly, as a necessary consequence, the idea of its sojourn on earth as a temporary passage or a departure from its highest eternal nature, and of a heaven beyond as its proper habitation. Thirdly, an emphasis on the development of the ethical and spiritual being as the means of ascension, and therefore the one proper business of life in this world of matter. So, very nicely, at the end of this paragraph, the last sentence that was read right now by Angelo, that Sri Aurobindo sums up the elements of this particular theory of reality. And that comes to, as he says over here, through all the various views that he has introduced. Firstly, that sense or intuition that there is something immortal in us. Mm-hmm. There is something that persists and is immortal in us. Now, that particularly, we can look at each of these intuitions, you see, and you see there's something very interesting. I mean, basic phenomenological, experiential, existential dimensions of our own experience are what we need to consider in trying to grapple with this material. If you think about, you know, this notion of the immortality of the spirit, why can we sort of think about any sort of immortality? Is it just just an option among other options? It's just an idea option. But early Indian or world, you may say even Greek philosophy, did not proceed like that. It did not proceed through trying to just put these mental options side by side. But it proceeded through actually presenting the intuition that would lead to such an option. And sometimes it would leave these intuitions in the mind, in the sort of general mind culture of the time for people to think about. See? Now, immortality of the human spirit, as he's saying, individual immortality of the human spirit. You see, if you look at it even apart from any traditions, you see there is a certain kind of experience that we all have, and that is that when we are children, we don't have any conception of death. I mean, you can ask this of yourself, and you can ask this of those that you know. You can ask them the question, and generally, unless it has appeared very early due to a death in the family that they have experienced, for a long time before one actually comes across death, this also relates to the whole Buddhist story of the Buddha being, told, or the king, Buddha's father being told that so long as your son doesn't come across, experiences of sickness, old age, and death, he will lead a kind of a paradisal life. See, it's only as we grow up and the facts of material reality become impressed upon us that we start becoming conscious about the mortality of human being. So immortality of human existence is a primary intuition in us. And even when we do become conscious of mortality, still inside somewhere this persists. And here it is brought out, for example, that's what I was talking about, the early traditions that introduced these ideas through intuitions, sometimes through stories. And you hear of that wonderful story in the Mahabharata, where the brothers are seeking for water in the forest, the five brothers. And each of them goes in turn, from youngest to oldest, and each they go, but they don't come back. And finally, the eldest brother, Yudhishthira, goes, and he finds that there is a wonderful lake, beautiful lake. And before he can drink the water, the spirit of the lake, the yaksha, talks to him and engages him in a conversation, basically tells him that he has certain questions to answer. If he can't answer those questions, he'll be killed, he'll die. And Yudhishthira answers the questions. But the final and important question of the yaksha, Yudhishthira, is this, that, we see all around us that everyone dies, yet we conduct our life as if we will never die. Why is this? No, I'm sorry. This is Yudhishthira's answer to the question, which is, the question by the yaksha is, what is the most mysterious thing in life? And Yudhishthira's answer is this. The most mysterious thing in life is the fact that everyone dies. We see it all around us. And yet we conduct our life as if we will never die. Now, the meaning of this entire thing, ultimately, in its deepest sense, is this. Why do we conduct our life as if we would never die? Because at some level, we cannot admit of the reality of death. We cannot admit of the reality of death maybe due to a variety of reasons. But at least one very fundamental reason is that we do not die. That in our most essential sense, we are a continuity. We are a persistence. And so this belief in the individual immortality of the human spirit is one of our most fundamental intuitions, one may say. Okay? Then he goes on, second, That is the idea that he has introduced right at the beginning, which is if there is an independence to human consciousness, then what is its native home? Can its native home be an alien world, a material world? Or are we justified in believing that it has a spirit world as its native home? In that case, this idea of a sojourn on earth is a temporary passage or a departure from its highest eternal nature and of a heaven beyond as its proper habitation. This is the second great principle, you may say, of this supraterrestrial theory of existence. And then the third one is necessary to give some value, weight, to our experience here in the material universe. We cannot get away. This is another very primary intuition. We may affirm in some sense that it doesn't matter what we do in matter. But in some deep sense, we cannot get away with that. That's also part of the reason why in the previous paragraph that we studied, or the previous theory that we studied, the notion of the Charvaks or those of the hedonists, the Epicures, is not considered to be something that will endure in the human field of culture. It is something that comes up as almost a kind of exception that proves the rule that to us, even a material existence which has no existence beyond has to have some weight to it, something that will give us an exercise of the will with an orientation. The will as a will to achieve some kind of a moral or ethical good. So that ethical dimension ties in even more substantially with existence in supracosmic planes beyond. And that's the third principle, as he's saying over here. An emphasis on the development of the ethical and spiritual being as the means of ascension, and therefore the one proper business of life in this world of matter. Okay? And then that's what brings us, you know, to all the philosophies that don't necessarily believe in reincarnation or don't believe in any kind of evolution of consciousness, or of any ultimate end to this terrestrial field. Even they will affirm an ethical content to human existence because of this. Now the rest of that paragraph from the beginning to that point actually deals with certain options having to do with this view of the material field as a place where there is some self-development taking place, development of consciousness taking place. The first one is that life on earth is a stage only. So there's a series of developments. It's a stage only, and the development of the being nearer to its original glory does not occur here. It occurs in a succession of worlds, which are so many other stages of its growth. Okay? So if the consciousness evolves, it evolves only very partially here. It evolves to a much greater extent in other worlds, according to this theory. And then it takes up the whole idea about the Vaishnav notion of Leela, which gives them an idea of evolution of consciousness here on this earth. In other words, as he says, through a protracted succession of births, we gather experiences till we arrive at a ripeness, a kind of a maturity of soul, and then perceive the world as the play of God, Leela, that this is the play of the individual soul with the divine person, the divine being. And yet, this play is enacted under the conditions of an eternal veil. So once we come to this realization within the veil, that the veil is a kind of, it's like a play, a drama, in which actors have put on certain robes and a certain play is being enacted, but all that is really for having the delight of relationship with the Supreme Person, Supreme Being. He is the player who plays with us. but it is under the conditions of a veil. So once we arrive at that realization, our immediate next sort of, you know, birth or disappearance of birth, one may say, would be a birth into this world in which the play is unveiled. And one experiences the supra-physical sort of delight of the Leela of God with the human souls.
Can we just read the next paragraph? Maybe we might not have the time, but we can read the next paragraph, I think.
Okay.
No, dilettante.
Yeah. These are the three fundamental ways of seeing, each with its mental attitude towards life, that can be adopted with regard to our existence. The rest are usually midway stations, or else variations or composites, which attempt to adapt themselves more freely to the complexity of the problem. For practically it is impossible for man, taken as a race, whatever a few individuals may succeed in doing, to guide his life permanently or wholly by the leading motive of any of these three attitudes uniquely, to the exclusion of the other's claim upon his nature. A confused amalgam of two or more of them, a conflict or division of his life motives between them, or some attempt at synthesis is his way of dealing with the various impulses of his complex being and the intuitions of his mind, to which they appeal for their sanction. Almost all men normally devote the major part of their energy to the life on earth, to the terrestrial needs, interests, desires, ideals of the individual and the race. It could not be otherwise, for the care of the body, the sufficient development and satisfaction of the vital and the mental being of man, the pursuit of high individual and large collective ideals, which start from the idea of an attainable human perfection, or nearer approach to perfection through his normal development, are imposed upon us by the very character of our terrestrial being. They are part of its law, its natural impulse and rule, its condition of growth. And without these things, man could not attain to his full manhood. Any view of our being which neglects, unduly belittles, or intolerantly condemns them is therefore, by that very fact, whatever its other truth or merit or utility, or whatever its suitability to individuals of a certain temperament or in a certain stage of spiritual evolution, unfit to be the general and complete rule of human living. Nature takes good care that the race shall not neglect these aims, which are a necessary part of her evolution, for they fall within the method and stages of the divine plan in us, and a vigilance for her first steps and for the maintenance of their mental and material ground is a preoccupation which she cannot allow to go into the background, since these things belong to the foundation and body of her structure.
Yeah. in passing, we'll take this up again next time, but in passing, I'd like to say that, you know, these three theories of existence that Sri Aurobindo has proposed have also some relationship with the idea of the avasthas of the Upanishads. In other words, the states of being of the Upanishads. And Upanishads sort of divides our states of being into four. And these four, you know, it's in the Mandukya Upanishad. These four are Jagrat, Swapna, Sushupti, and Turiya. So, of these, if we think of Jagrat, the awakened state, or the state of waking consciousness. Awakened is a little confusing, because often people think of awakened as fully conscious. But the state of waking consciousness, of our usual waking consciousness, we may think of as the terrestrial cosmic theory of existence. The Swapna condition we may think of as the supraterrestrial theory of existence. And the state of the Sushupti, we may think of, and leading to the Turiya, we may think of as the supra-cosmic. The second is supra-terrestrial, and that is relating to Swapna. And the supra-cosmic and it would relate to Sushupti and Turiya. Now, each of these states is actually a state of Brahman. Brahman or Supreme Being holds itself as each one of these states through a specific act of tapas. And therefore, each of them has a reality. Now, Sri Aurobindo is pointing out in this particular paragraph we just read that the reality has a certain kind of coherence to it. And that coherence is based in the terrestrial view. The terrestrial view imposes itself upon us because there is such a powerful concentration of Brahman keeping itself in the waking field of consciousness. That makes us also outward turn, makes us also so concerned with our material existence. And therefore that concern with our material existence is the divine's way of ensuring that something gets done over here. And that is why, as he says, what we have studied earlier, the relationship of the terrestrial and the supraterrestrial is one of a certain kind of ethical orientation which gives us the notion of where we are going to go, what is going to happen to us, what is our transitional impulse. And so evolutionary power keeps us occupied with the terrestrial field until and unless its purpose is served. We'll get more into this next time, but I thought it might be good to relate these three theories with the avasthas, because in a sense, that gives us a coherence to it.